Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about empowering each of us with the perspective and tools to grow and change. I hope as you join this podcast today that your life and family are doing well and prospering. Thank you for the messages and feedback about Open Your Eyes. We love hearing from you, and we hope that this podcast continues to help you find a few insights and a bit more hope to live a happier life. You know, it's our firm belief that a powerful way to do that is to open our eyes to new ways of seeing life. You see, at the foundation of our behavior and beliefs is the way we see the world and ourselves in it. So hopefully this podcast can give you a new perspective and a few tools to think and live better. Let's get started. Today, I'd like to talk about switching and scrolling. From the outset, this is not a podcast about obesity or weight loss, but I want to talk about it for a minute. There's a very valuable lesson to be learned from it. In the United States, obesity rates have, over many decades, been on the increase. In fact, in the 1960s, 14% of the adult population was obese, with obesity being defined as the percentage of adults and young adults with a body mass index over 30. In the year 1988, the rates had increased to 24%, then by 2005 to 34%, and in 2023, the rate of obesity in our country was 40%. That means 4 out of 10 people are in this category. The point is that just about every year, obesity increased. In fact, the average weight gain for an adult between 1960 and 2002 was 24 pounds. In the 1980s, the obesity rates increased at the fastest rate alongside the fast growth in McDonald's and Burger King franchises. For proof, McDonald's added 500 new restaurants in the 70s, then 5,400 in the 80s, and 11,000 in the 1990s. The point is that due to a variety of factors, obesity increased over a lifetime. And the costs of obesity are immense. You may not think as a taxpayer you pay for the nation's obesity, but you do. Most of the costs come through Medicare and Medicaid. The cost to taxpayers are estimated to be $8.2 trillion over the next decade. And by the way, 25% of the federal taxes you pay go to Medicare and Medicaid. You know, this is how epidemics are made and how they grow over time. Over time, our behavior changes. When I was a kid, McDonald's was miles away. You went once a month for a family outing. Nowadays, fast food in one form or the other is a dinner each day for some families. So we've had time over the years to address our approach to healthy eating, but for some reason, we haven't made a lot of progress as a society. Now, there's another epidemic taking root. It's been underway for several decades, but it's growing at its fastest rate right now. We have the opportunity to do something about it in our own lives and family, but the question is, will we? 20 years ago, my work was mostly overseas, so I would take 2 or 3 flights to arrive at a destination in Asia or Europe. Usually before each flight, I would buy a physical newspaper or two. This was still very common at the time, and I'd have a free hour or two to sit in my seat on the plane while everyone was boarding and begin to read. Reading a physical newspaper is a bit different than the way we consume news today. I would start to read a story on the front page and then usually move to a different page to finish that story, then to the next article. Then I would read each page, not every article, but most, but reading, not scanning. For sure, I would read the first news section and the sports section. I'd rarely read the entertainment section, but I would spend an hour or so in the newspaper. Then I would work or read the rest of the flight. I always had a book in my bag, and to relax, I would read a novel or a book that interested me. I gave myself a book budget that allowed me to come home with a book or two. And this was a bit of an adventure and allowed me to try and find a few books that I would like and I would start reading. It allowed me to explore a few topics I'd never considered before. But I read and explored and engaged. Now, compare this with my travel today. I have my phone and on my phone is the iNews app. I open my phone and scroll through my iNews. I find myself mostly reading headlines. I'm let down because the headlines are so sensational that when I click through the article and I find the writing, it's much less than I thought it was going to be. It takes multiple paragraphs to get to the subject, and it's empty news. So I find myself dismissing articles that sound the same. So I move from headline to headline without reading much of the articles in depth. I scan for the news, and I scan and scroll and scan through articles and lack much depth in what I read. I switch from one article to the next at breakneck speed, sometimes every 10 seconds or so, and I switch from one topic to the next, and every so often I'll find an article that matters. But my attention has been hijacked, and I switch and scroll too much and read too less. On my phone or books on my Kindle app. But there's also movies and a dozen or two apps that can take my short-term attention. And I feel like I'm engaging my short-span attention, but never engaging my deeper long-term attention. Inside, a voice says I should engage in something with more depth, but my habit of switch and scroll has taken over my will, and I stay at it until my mind is tired and I feel that I've wasted a lot of time. Now, there's amazing electronic tools today. I can bookmark news stories to return to. I can share news. I can immediately search a topic if the news story captures my imagination. So many possibilities, but my temptation is to do this less and switch and scroll more. I've lost my desire to go deep. Now, maybe your experience is the same. Maybe when you wake up in the morning, you reach for your phone and your first exercise of the day is to switch and scroll through the news or your social media. That happens before exercise or reading or other things. And if that's the case, you have plenty of company. And right off, first thing in your day, your brain is addicted to switching and scrolling. Sometimes you switch and scroll so long, you cut into your exercise time or other things. It is a proven fact that when we read fast and switch a lot, we skim. We don't really read. And when we do that, we absorb less and less. In my PhD studies regarding how we learn, I researched the fact that our brains can really only focus on one or maybe two thoughts. We may say that we can multitask and handle more, but the lion's share of research shows it's impossible. When we multitask, we operate in the shallow end of the pool, thinking and processing at a very superficial level. And that is where very little retention, critical thinking, or learning takes place. There we make little sense or connections in what we do and think. And if we are switching topics from one thing to the next thing, our brain never has the chance to get into learning mode. We remain in entertainment mode, as if we're just passing time, but never learning. You know, in his book, Stolen Focus, Johann Hari talks about the switching effect. He says, there are three ways that switching degrades your ability to focus. The first is called the switch cost effect. There's broad scientific evidence for this now. And imagine that you're doing your tax return and you receive a text. And you look at it. It's only a glance, taking 5 seconds, and then you go back to your tax return. But in that moment, your brain has to reconfigure when it goes from one task to another. You have to remember what you were doing before, and you have to remember what you thought about it, and this takes a little bit of time. When this happens, the evidence shows that your performance drops, you're slower. So if you check your texts often while you're trying to work, you aren't only losing the little bursts of time you spend looking at the text, you're also losing the time it takes to refocus afterward, which can be much longer. And if you do this for a lot of time, you're not really thinking, but wasting your thoughts on switching. That's just wasted brain processing time. A small study commissioned by Hewlett-Packard looked at the IQ of some of their workers in two situations. At first, they tested their IQ when they were not being distracted or interrupted. Then they tested their IQ when they were receiving emails and phone calls. The study found that the technological distraction, just getting emails and calls, caused a drop in the worker's IQ by an average of 10 points. To give you a sense of how big that is, in the short term, That's twice the knock to your IQ that you get when you smoke cannabis. So this suggests, in terms of being able to get work done, you're better off getting stoned at your desk than checking your text and Facebook messages. From there, the research shows it gets worse. The second way switching harms your attention is what we might call the screw-up effect. When you switch between tasks, errors that wouldn't have happened otherwise start to creep in, because your brain is error-prone. When you switch from task to task, your brain has to backtrack a little bit and pick up and figure out where it left off, and it can't do that perfectly. So glitches start to occur. Instead of spending critical time doing deep thinking, your thinking's more superficial because you're spending a lot of time correcting errors and backtracking. Then there's the third cost, one that you'll only notice in the medium or longer term, which we might call the creativity drain. You're likely to be significantly less creative when you live this way. Why? Because where do new thoughts and innovation come from? They come from your brain shaping new connections out of what you've seen and heard and learned. Your creativity has a lot to do with connections to other things in your brain. Your mind, given free, undistracted time, will automatically think back over everything it absorbed, and it will start to draw links between them in new ways. This all takes place beneath the level of your conscious mind. But this process is how new ideas pop together, and suddenly two thoughts that you didn't think had a relationship suddenly have a relationship. A new idea is born. But if you spend a lot of this brain processing time switching and scrolling, you're simply giving your brain less opportunity to follow your associative links down to new places and creative thoughts. You know, I talked to several friends who were educators about this phenomenon. They wholeheartedly agree. Here's what they said. They said they've noticed that many students cannot get out of their switch and scroll way of thinking, that their brains are now wired with a lack of attention. And when it comes to working on their degree, if they can't get it fast, their level of anxiety increases. With higher anxiety, they don't even attempt to go deep into a subject. I've seen the same thing in my university classes. When you're in switch and scroll addiction mode, there's a natural resistance to focusing or going deep on a topic. You say to yourself, it's time to focus or study or read, and there's this natural resistance, a chemical signal that surfaces that says, in a sense, that it's not going to be fun or satisfying, and it will feel difficult. So we don't do it. You know, in the mountains of North Carolina, a program called Camp Grounded runs a summer camp for adults, but with one strict rule: no devices, no watches, no screen. Participants surrender their phones at the gate and spend 4 days hiking, cooking, and talking face to face. When it began, many campers reported phantom vibrations in the first 24 hours, feeling their phones buzz, even though they didn't have them. Have you ever had a phantom vibration? I have. But by the third day, the symptoms vanished. Campers described longer conversations, deeper laughter, and a sense of time returning to normal. One attendee said, "I didn't realize how flat my attention had become until it expanded again." A Stanford psychology study that followed up with these participants at camp 2 weeks after returning home found that many had lower cortisol levels and higher sustained attention scores than before camp. A few years back, a former Facebook vice president and an ex-design ethicist publicly revealed how Facebook and other platforms intentionally designed features to hijack user attention. They showed that Facebook's likes and notification loops were developed using behavioral psychology principles similar to those in slot machines, creating dopamine-driven feedback cycles that reward frequent checking and micro interruptions. They later founded the Center for Humane Technology, arguing that such design practices had created a global attention crisis, fragmenting our focus and shortening the duration of undistracted thought. Independent studies have confirmed the behavioral effects. MIT researchers found that users check their phones on average 85 times a day, often unconsciously. These microchecks correlate with higher anxiety and lower cognitive persistence. Well, after learning about this, I checked myself as to how many times a day I checked my phone, either for the time, a text, an email, or worse, just out of habit. I was closer to 100 times per day, and I'm not active on social media. Imagine how many times this happens to people that are. Now, most of you listening today have heard of the concept of attention economy. The idea that in a world of abundant information, human attention becomes the scarce resource to be allocated because attention now has economic value. Social media platforms, advertisers, and media compete for that attention. The more attention they get, the more money they make. Linked to this is the concept of attention theft, where attention is commandeered without the user's explicit consent or benefit. For example, marketers may deploy automatic pop-ups, push notifications, autoplays, and algorithmic hooks that draw users' eyes and time, often in ways that the user didn't opt into. Tim Wu coined attention theft to describe such unethical marketing strategies. Meanwhile, critics argue that attention is the battleground in modern media. In effect, every notification, algorithmic bait, or attention-pulling design may act as a micro-interruption, which forces us into switching and scrolling. When this concept of attention theft was first introduced, it focused on the lack of productivity in the workplace, and the effect was tremendous. Studies showed that because of our addiction to switching, we've lost about 40% of our productivity. But the effect is so much more than what happens in the workplace. The real epidemic is what happens to each of us when we switch and scroll. Switching destabilizes identity. It fragments memory. It disrupts coherence. And over time, it can reshape who we think we are. And from everything I've read and what I've personally experienced and observed, there are several primary effects we experience as a result of too much switching and scrolling in our lives. First, because we think in the shallows, rarely sinking into depth, our levels of anxiety are raised. And this is proven out in several studies. The first showed that when you switch your attention from one thing to the next, your brain has an emotional response. It's called stress response. You've experienced it. When you switch, just a little bit of stress comes about. The problem with that is when this happens hundreds of times a day, your physiological pattern is to remain in this slightly anxious state, and soon you can't leave that state. Another famous study revealed that when we switch attention or tasks, our body releases small bursts of cortisol and adrenaline. And if we remain in this state, we have constant background anxiety. Frequent switching, especially when triggered by notifications, messages, or pings, undermines a person's sense of autonomy. Feeling out of control over one's attention is a major predictor of anxiety. When your environment dictates when and where your attention goes, you experience learned helplessness. And switching leaves behind attention residue, fragments of the previous task still actively working in our memory. And the more cluttered our working memory becomes, the harder it is to stay organized. And this results in us feeling overwhelmed. And last, we create attention habits to start to rule our life, meaning we have mental resistance when we try to do something that requires deeper cognitive attention for a longer period of time. In his book, Johan tells us this story to illustrate that we need to wake up to what's happening to us. There's an old metaphor that villagers are at the river one day, and they notice a dead body floating down the river. So they do the right thing. They take it out and give it an appropriate burial. The next day, two bodies come down the river, and they do the same thing. They bury the bodies. And this goes on for a while, and finally they start to wonder, I wonder where these bodies are coming from, and if we should do something to stop that. So they go upriver to find out. We can treat these switch and scroll things that are happening to us, but we need to fully understand why they are happening for us. It's time for us to go upriver. Here's the point. We're living in the middle of an epidemic. Like obesity, It's not happening overnight, but over a long period of time. In your life and mine, the effects of switching and scrolling are impacting us and our families. And if we remain in this state and let our attention be stolen over a period of years, we may become something other than who we want to become. So, what can we do to change our habits and avoid the impact of attention switching in our life? Here's what I've learned. Setting aside time each day away from switching, scrolling, devices, and other things is essential. And using this time to go deeper in your thinking is also essential. Now, I have a habit of walking every evening. Some evenings I can't, but rather than stay in front of a digital screen, I try. And I walk and I use my mind and I think, I listen to a podcast or I focus for 45 minutes or so. No social media, no texting, no interruptions. This is in addition to my morning exercise, but it's more about unplugging than it is about exercise. Now, you may choose something different. Perhaps you unplug and read or write or take a class, learn a new skill, study a different language, start a new project. Whatever it may be, use an entirely different part of your brain and improve your emotional and mental wellness. In San Mateo High School in California, they noticed plummeting attention in classrooms, rising anxiety, and social conflicts traced to phone use. Students were checking messages dozens of times in class, so the school adopted a magnetic pouch policy. Students locked their phones in magnetic pouches during the school day. Teachers could focus on teaching, and students could engage in person. Within weeks, teachers reported more discussion, fewer behavioral issues, and better test performance. And students admitted they were initially resistant, but later felt freer and less anxious. Removing constant digital stimulation allowed attention and social connection to grow. It also showed that focus is not just an individual skill, it's an environmental condition that can be designed and protected. The Boston Consulting Group, a global management consulting firm, noticed that consultants were working late into the night and constantly checking emails, even on vacation. This constant attention switching created exhaustion, errors, and higher turnover. In a Harvard-led experiment, BCG teams scheduled one predictable night off per week, a time when no one could contact them for work. They also created focus hours for deep, uninterrupted project work. After several months, productivity increased, burnout decreased, and employees reported stronger team trust. The initiative later spread across many Boston Consulting Group offices. This leads us to the next suggestion, an unplugged night or day each week. Could you do this? And if you did, what would you do during your unplugged time? Could Sunday afternoon, for example, be a reading time? During the day, could you have 2 hours of unplugged deep dive time for really diving into your work? Could you get into the habit of leaving phone and text for a while to do this? One expert suggests that you create places in your home where children can't access or see devices. For example, have only one room in the house where children can use the phone or tablet. Keep these devices out of bedrooms, the kitchen, the dining room, and the car. At the same time, create times in your schedule where children cannot see or access a device. Narrow down usage to certain times each day. Or take a weekly tech Sabbath where everyone in the family takes a 24-hour break from phones and tablets. Now, Johan would argue that it's not just social media that's robbing our focus and stealing our attention. Another argument is that our children are experiencing fundamental change in their lives as well. He writes, in the U.S., only 10% of children spend any time playing freely outdoors on a regular basis. Childhood now happens overwhelmingly behind closed doors or in structured play. The way children spend their time at school has also changed dramatically. The school systems in the U.S. have been redesigned so that teachers are forced to spend the majority of their time preparing and drilling children for tests. And in the U.S., only 73% of elementary schools now have a form of recess. Children are being deprived of the chance to develop intrinsic motives. You see, most people learn focus by doing something that's either very important or very interesting to them. The way you learn to focus is automatic if there's something that interests you or absorbs you or thrills you. But if you're a kid today, you live almost all of your life according to what adults tell you to do. And how do you find meaning when your day is filled from 7 in the morning to 9 at night when you go to bed with someone else's idea of what's important? If you don't have any free time to figure out what emotionally intrigues you, I'm not sure you're going to be able to find personal meaning. Now, I'm not sure exactly who's right in the debate about how to raise children, but I suspect the author who made this point may be right that we prescribe too much of what happens to our children, that they need some time to be unplugged as well, unplugged from parents and how the parents want them to play or do. This sounds right to me. You know, I dove into the research for a bit to see if there was clear scientific evidence that we are overscheduling our kids and the impact of doing so. And it seems clear that overscheduling can lead to anxiety, even depression in our kids, that self-directed functioning may also be reduced in cases when kids are prescribed other activities. But other research suggests that scheduling in a broad set of activities can help children be more well-rounded. However, all research agreed that we need to let children lead at times where they spend their own time. Give them unstructured time for free play and imagination. Regardless, if you were to walk away from anything from this podcast today, it might be to look at your own switching and scrolling habits and start to pay attention to how you might manage your switching just like you manage your weight. You may not be able to change the trends of obesity in our society, but you can change them in your own life and home. Likewise, with a little effort, we can reverse the trends and effects of switching and scrolling in our own lives. And with a little effort, we can begin to bring a greater level of health into our lives as we learn to live with new tech and trends all around us. So try a few of the things we talked about today and watch. You just might feel a greater level of peace and health come into your life as a result. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to share this podcast with a friend. And join us next week for another podcast as we learn to open our eyes to who and what we can become.